Today on Coding 101, we heard your feedback. We decided to bring back somebody very special from Module 1. Stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Coding 101 is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Hello and welcome back to Coding 101.
Hi.
It's the show where we show the secrets of the code monkeys. I'm Father Robert Ballasaire.
And I am Shannon Morris. And for the next 30 minutes, we're going to get you all learned up on somebody very special who has a very special place in our hearts.
He does, yeah. I mean,
We missed him.
Yeah, Shannon, you were talking about him earlier, a man that we hold near and dear to our hearts.
We
did listen to you. We know that you missed him. You may remember him from this. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, we welcome back to the show Mr. Woo! Lou Maresca. Lou, so good to see you.
Great to see you guys. How's it going?
Pretty good. Now, Shannon, you remember when we first started the show, right? We were talking about what we wanted to do.
I don't know, that was a long time ago.
I know, we're episode like 19 or whatever now.
Yeah, I remember.
And one of the things that we decided is we wanted this wild card period in
yes.
between the modules, because we didn't want to jump straight from one language to the next.
Right. We want to give you some breathing room. So we decided to do two episodes in between each module where we interview really interesting people that are programmers, and that's what they do for a living.
Exactly. And the idea was to give people who are watching the show a little of incentive. You know, let them see what you actually can do once you get learned up and once you are a code monkey, once you are a code warrior. And that's why we've asked Lou to come back onto the show, because Lou, when you were here being our code warrior, and by the way, you were fantastic. You were absolutely the trailblazer for what the code warrior does. We never got a chance to talk to you about how you got into coding and why you chose the languages that you did. Are you willing to talk to us today?
Oh yeah, definitely. It depends on what time you got, though.
Oh, we got all the time you want. Lou, let's start off with this.
Sure.
What's your background? I mean, what got you into computer science? What got you into programming? Why did you decide to head into the software, the computer science side of the computer revolution?
Yeah. So back in the 80s, when I think my first thing was the Atari 2600, I loved the Outlaw game at that time, which allowed me to do multiplayer and so on. But from there, I found that like you could put these programming cartridges into this thing too. And I was pretty young at that time, so I had friends that would go and bring them over, and they would throw these cartridges that had like small pieces of code on them and run them on the screen. Then a little bit later, I think it was like 1984, 1985. I think that was 1984. For me, it was massive relevance for me, because I think that's when my dad won a that's when my dad won an IBM 5170, I think. And it was at the time, he had, even as an organic chemist geek, he thought, you know, I had this thought that this new Apple PC came out called the Apple Macintosh, and I think it's probably a little bit more user friendly than this PC. And so this IBM, and so he traded it in. I think it was like around $2,500 at the time, and he traded it in, and he got this Apple Macintosh. I think it's back there right now, if you see it back
Aww.
There. And,
is it the 2SE?
Yeah.
Or?
No, it's the original.
That's the original?
Serial, wow. That's the original right there,
wow.
Yeah.
Let me just tell you right now, don't let Brian touch that. The last classic Mac he touched, he broke.
Yeah, and it still works. It's kind of crazy.
Wow.
At the time, my dad had gotten all these these 3.5 floppy disks. He had a whole bunch of them. He got Deja Vu and Airborne and Typing Tutor. And, man, I was hooked on that thing.
That reminds me of when I was a little kid. I don't think I was the same age as you, but I was, because I was born in the 80s. But my dad also got me into programming and into you know, being on a computer day by day with all his 3.5-inch floppies.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, and, what language were you programming in, Lou? I mean, back then.
So back then, it was the Mac Basic, I think. They had Mac Basic, Mac Pascal, and then some other, like, development system, which was a special board you had to plug into the serial port. But at that time, it was Mac Basic. And so I started learning Mac Basic from the ground up. And for many years after that, I did Mac Basic. I had an Apple IIgs after that. And from there, I started doing bulletin board systems from the Mac from the 2GS, and then Prodigy and AOL and scripting for them. And then and from there and there, I just kept building up. And then I think it wasn't until the 90s I actually got my IBM PC. I think it was like, because I think at the time, I think it was a 486 that was running in the 2GS. And I think they offered the Pentium chip. And so I was really interested. I started getting really all into obsessed with hardware and how fast were things were and bus speeds and horsepower, because I found the modems were actually getting faster than the PC that I had. And so it's like, it's time for me to move off of this thing and move something I can move into other things.
So were you in school at the time?
No, I was just in middle school. I was just in what they call middle school at the time, which is like sixth or seventh grade. And then I just moved to high school, I started moving more into understanding hardware and understanding that it was a big ecosystem of building PCs. So that's when I thought it's time for me to jump over to IBM, where I can start building stuff and changing, you know, the I/O cards and all that stuff. And then that's where I found, you know, that BASIC was also transferable over to that too. So I, you know, took some classes there. Even in high school, they offered some like electives, and I started doing BASIC. And even I think my first application in BASIC there was a dice game that actually was a console app, and it would roll the dice on the screen, and then it would, you know, randomly choose numbers and stuff. It was pretty cool.
Yeah. Now, do you remember when you first started programming for the PC? Like you, I was drawn to the PC just because I liked the ability to change the hardware. You know, I loved working with my hands.
And absolutely.
It was one thing to be able to program something, but, you know, that tactile feel is like none other. But when you were writing those first programs, do you remember what were the biggest challenges for you?
So the cool thing about BASIC was, it was more of a trial and error. It was like it was procedural, meaning you just wrote the code, you tried it out, you saw if it broke, and then you'd go back and fix it. And I'd put in like little statements in there to say if this got returned or an error code got returned from the system, I'd go and do something else. So it was like lots of trial and error. But in order to do other things like talk to hardware, it became very complex, because then you had to work with, you know, IRQs, interrupts, and all this other stuff that had to do with the operating system. And so I really didn't understand any of that. And it wasn't until actual college that I actually had to start learning that stuff. But yeah, that was the most challenging part, is I got limited by what was on the screen. And when I wanted to do like connect to BBSs or do other things over the modem or the internet, I guess at the time, I had to learn, you know, how to program against these IRQ ports and IO ports and stuff. And it was a little bit over my head at that time. So, one thing I started in high school too, is I started building PCs, and I found out that it was actually cheaper to get a wholesaler vendor's license. So I got one of those, and my good friend of mine, Adam Jackson, which I guess you guys, some of you might know him. He's a founder of the Doctors on Demand program with Dr. Phil's son. And he and I started building PCs for little companies in town, Mailbox, et cetera. And I built some for Money Mutual of New York. And that's where I started getting into just hardware in general. And when I went to school, I actually went to school for electrical engineering. I got into like VLSI, which is, I don't know if you guys know, it's very, very large scale integrations, building processors on the screen. Mm-hmm. And VHDL, which is a hardware language. And I went to co-op and intern at Intel, where I did like SPICE simulations and stuff. And then when I got back to school, I found that I really liked the fact that I could simulate things on the screen. So I could simulate physical hardware on the screen using these simulation programs. And so I found, you know what? What would it take for me to go and get computer science too? Because then I could program. I found that it was only an additional semester. So, and at that time, they didn't have computer engineering.
Oh,
so I was
awesome.
Like, okay, well, yeah, so I'll go do both. And so I did both, and I found that I was going to do minor, but then I found that if I sent another semester, I could actually get both. And so I got an electrical engineering and a computer science degree. But I did some really cool things that really got me into programming there, which were, I got to do SAE car, which was, I don't know if you guys have heard of SAE car there, but basically it's like the Automotive Engineering Society. and you got to build. We got to build a. They got to build a car, and I got to do all the electronics for the car and program. Cool. Yeah, and so I got to do all the electronics for the car, and I got to program like all the accelerometers and everything in it. At the time, I think they had these small accelerometers that were just starting out. And so we built a lot of things for that, and I got to do ACM. I even got to do something called Pumpkin Chunkin'. I don't know if you guys ever heard of that.
Yes,
but
of course.
I freaking did that, and that was awesome because I got to do. I built a rail gun, the first rail gun in the competition, but we could never get it out of the laboratory because it had so much current that it would just fry the pumpkins.
Wait,
and so we would have like pumpkin pie.
This was like a Sabo enclosed pumpkin that could be fired down a rail gun.
Yeah, it was like on this little carriage that was made of carbon. Okay. It was made of carbon. It wasn't conductive. And we'd put this pumpkin on this thing, and it would be this massive copper rail. We spent a couple $1,000s. The university actually gave us money for it. And we never got it off the ground because, like I said, it was so much current. We had like the first battery parallel series system, which was all these boat batteries plugged together, and it was just frying the pumpkins a couple thousand currents.
Good pumpkin.
That's awesome.
I remember making a rail gun, and the problem that we always had was we passed so much current through it that it would actually collapse the structure if you didn't use the right material.
That's
such
what we chose.
A strong copper, electromagnetic sure. field.
Go ahead.
Let me ask you this, Loop. So we have a lot of people who watch Coding 101, and they get their first bit of programming, their first bit of knowledge, and they jump into whatever language it is that they're going to use, C#, Python, Java. But then they don't go any further. I'd say 90% of the people who will watch this show, who will start programming, will eventually get enough knowledge to be able to understand what's going on and to maybe write simple programs. But they don't go into that next level where they say, I want this to be my career. This is what I want to do every day. What is it? What attracted you to the field where you thought, you know, this problem solving, this idea of taking something from the real world and turning it into a series of if then else statements. why would you suddenly say this is what I want to do with the rest of my life?
You know, it was the part of the age of computing when it started getting into microelectronics, and I was just fascinated by. I mean, I worked for companies like Anheuser-Busch where I got to program little robotics that would pick beer pallets up and stuff. And I just was like completely sold on these things that I get to program, you know, AI and artificial intelligence to pick up beer pallets and put them in a truck, for Christ's sake. So I was like, I was just sold on programming. And just like you said, is what really got me interested was the synergy between not only just PCs. I could care less about PCs. In fact, I got bored of them. I stopped building them, and I moved on to other things. And I started building, you know, IC circuits that I could program even before they had, you know, Arduino and Neduino and all that stuff. And I just got into doing that and just making these things do something for me that would, you know, benefit me at that time, not everyone else, but benefit me. And so that's really what got me into doing things, just trying different things out. And nowadays it's so much easier. I mean, you got Arduino boards and Neduino boards and Android and, you know, mm-hmm. you know, C#. Neduino lets you use C# on these little boards, and you can program, you know, on, you know, different processors and different types of platforms. I mean, it's just an unlimited zone for you to try stuff out. So that was what for me really sold it.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because I remember, like you, back in the day when I was programming on my IBM PC or my trash 80. One of the most challenging things to do was to make it interact with something in the real world. You know, get through that serial port, get through that parallel port, and actually trigger something. And you like you said, I always had difficulty playing with interrupts and figuring out, well, how do I actually access something that's not inside the computer's memory? But then we've got this revolution of all these integrated products, these embedded products, these circuit boards, things like the Arduino, which now have people programming in a dedicated platform that is designed to do nothing else but interact with the real world. That's another jump, right? I mean, embedded programming is nothing like working in, say, C# or Python.
Yeah, I mean, what I would have given to have something like that, you know, 20 years ago. I mean, like you said, I mean, it's makes so easy now. You know, you simple program, you can even do simple program like C or whatever, and you can even use, like you said, C#, but you can use these boards and they have special interfaces and IDEs for you to just plug in easy code. Just like we were writing in the Coding 101 samples. But then you could go and talk to other things. Like you can go and have like a temperature monitor and a accelerometer and a gyroscope and all these different things. And you can talk and get information back from them really easily just using these little interfaces. And it makes it so much easier nowadays. It's unlimited possibilities. That's why I'm always so blown away, like that little dial that you can buy for your house, the Nest.
Right.
I was always wondering why there's not more of stuff like that, because it's so much easier to build things nowadays. That is like that's not innovative anymore. It's like people could build things that can drive cars by themselves. They can build a little freaking Nest thing, right?
Well, just so. Your background. I mean, with mm-hmm. Hack5, and you're going off to DEF CON in a couple of weeks here. You deal with a lot of people who do nothing but embedded.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's the way that they've chosen. They think that those specialized devices are easier to program for, easier to mm-hmm. work with, easier to design than general purpose computers made to do a single thing.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of times when you run into some people at DEF CON, they want to show you a thing. They want to show you a physical thing that they have coded in some sort of way. And a lot of times they have a lot more fun with that kind of thing.
Right, yep. Right. Yep. What about that, Lou? Do you think, I mean, obviously you're big on embedded devices, but let's say we were to offer a embedded programming module on Coding 101, and actually we'd probably have to offer a few. We'd probably have to do Arduino.
We should do it.
We probably should do something, and something in the Motorola series, maybe, you know, Propeller. But how would that be different? I mean, we've got people like 8-Bit Steve in the chat room who's saying, look, embedded device programming is nothing like purely software languages, which I understand. But what's different? Well, what do you have to do differently? How do you have to think differently to program for a specific embedded device rather than sort of a general use compiler?
Yeah, I mean, some of them you have to use special compilers for, some of them special languages. Like when I said NetGuino, for me, you can program in C#, just like you're programming a console application and talk to special interfaces, and then the compiler compiles it down using a special compiler switch and linker, and it will compile it down to machine code or whatever, and then you can run it on these little devices. I mean, there's pretty much unlimited possibilities, but most of them, again, like you said, some of them require special languages, some of them require special compilers that will only work on these special CPUs or processors that are on them. But again, they're not that difficult to set up, and you can use things like the IDEs you've used in the past, like Visual Studio and some of the other smaller ones like Eclipse for Java, stuff like that. And some of them allow you to program Java on them. So, I mean, there's a lot of possibilities. There's not just one environment, and you're not stuck on doing one thing.
We've got M5 in the chat room who says, well, is it like dealing with an API? not really. I mean, again, one of the things that I've noticed about doing programming for embedded devices is because the instruction set is typically much simpler than you would get for a general-purpose computer, you know which hardware you have to work with, and you know what its capabilities are. So right. Programming for that device isn't nearly as complicated as well, I have to use this API, this API, I have to trigger this, I have to bring in this package. It's typically what you see is what you get, right?
Yep. Yeah, it's pretty limited. It's pretty limited to what to the interfaces. They describe what the CPU can do, and there's usually a very limited set of stuff. And then once you figure out what it can do, you can build off of that, right? And so you can, and then again, there's a lot of, you can talk to a lot of I/O stuff too. So they give you very simple interfaces to talk to I/O as well. And so that makes it, you know, modularized, and that lets you plug stuff in and become unlimited possibilities. So,
yeah. We've got MaxWave3 in the chat room is saying, I noticed that Lou MM has an old Mac in the background.
Yeah.
And he works for Macintosh. I think this is a good time for us to go into the fact that, you work for Microsoft, right? I mean, you're a Microsoft employee. You're a Microsoft programmer.
So that's a good question. So I worked for Microsoft, I think almost 11 years now. My 10-year anniversary was this past January. So
congratulations.
Thank you. But it's crazy. Is I actually was doing all this stuff. I worked for Ford, or a subsidiary of Ford for a while. It's called Dana Corp, where I did some research. In fact, I have a couple patents from them. And then all of a sudden, I got a job with a tax software company. That was weird because I wanted to try something else. And so I went and got a job with a tax software company called Creative Solutions. And they did a package called UltraTax, which is not very exciting.
Boring.
Yeah, it's not very exciting for anybody. But the funny thing that I got excited about was I got to talk to customers at that point, and I got to talk to people. And CPAs are the most eccentric people you can possibly meet. I hate to stereotype them, but they really are. They're just crazy people, and they want to do crazy things. And I got to talk to these people, and then change the software. I think now it's owned by Thomson Reuters, but I got to change the software to do that. And it, like you said, it was kind of boring. So when I went back to school. It was an internship, and I went back to school. And at the time, Microsoft was just starting their MBS division, which is the Microsoft Business Division. And they had bought a company called Great Plains in 2001. And I went to a career fair up in University of Michigan, and they had a career fair, and they had Microsoft and a recruiter there. And I went through my 30-second pitch of all the things I had done in the last 6 years at college or whatever, and he was just like, "Oh my God, we got to get you, over to because I did some wacky stuff." And they were like, "Oh, yeah, get you over to interview." So I got like maybe 2 or 3 months later, I got a call and they sent me over and I interviewed for, at the time it was MSN Office and the MBS division.
Oh wow!
And to be honest with you, I wasn't very impressed with Microsoft because working at Intel at the time.
This episode is going to go out over the internet, right?
Yeah, I know.
Employer.
I've been there for 10 years. Obviously.
Okay.
So, anyways, at the time I worked at Intel. At the time it was Digital Corp, and then it was bought by Intel. But I interned there, and like they were just not impressed with Microsoft because they were. It was Itanium processor at that time, and there wasn't much support for it, and they were just, freaking out. And then, I worked for other companies that didn't use Microsoft technologies. They use IBM AIX and Linux machines and Unix machines and Sun Microsystems. And so there wasn't much Microsoft, for me at least, that I came into contact with. So I wasn't really impressed. And when I heard about C# and .NET at the time, I think it was 1.0 at that time, they were saying, "Oh, it's so slow. It doesn't do anything. They're coming out with technologies that don't make any sense anymore." And so when I went there with I had no expectations whatsoever. I just went there just to kind of see what was going on. And I went through this grueling interviewing with them. And they asked me all types of questions from algorithm questions to programming common stuff around working through trees and stuff like that with, software trees. And then they asked me different things about the problem solving, if you had, a rubber band and a piece of wood and you needed to cross a bridge. It was like really strange stuff, right? Yeah.
It's weird.
So yeah. And so anyways, I went through like 3 days, 12 hours of just interviewing with all these three different teams. And I was just exhausted. And, I had no expectation. In fact, I went back to school and I was finishing off my final year and I spent 11 months going to school. I didn't hear anything from them. I just thought, Microsoft, bleh. And then my senior year, I actually had accepted another job, and I got a call, and they said, "We want you to work for the MSN or the MBS division." And I said, "You have a choice." And I said, "Well, I don't like MSN because I don't know what MSN is, and I don't care. So maybe I'll try the MBS stuff." And so I went to work for MBS, and I found out there was this massive possibility of doing things. I learned things about. I was the developer tools division of their Great Plains software, which is a big ERP. You've talked about it on Twiat, which is enterprise resource planning software. It does everything from sales, customers, to invoicing and general ledger, financials, HR. Does everything for your business. And so I got to learn about things like SQL Server and C++. I didn't ever program C++. Well, I guess I programmed a little bit in college, but not to the length that they did. Visual Studio. Proprietary scripting languages, and then I also learned about .NET there. So I was, and at that time, I think it was 1.1 they were getting to.
I would consider you being very well-rounded when it comes to different code languages. Did Microsoft require you to get any kind of certifications or anything like that beforehand?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, they did, actually. At the time, Visual Studio was still getting picked up really well as IDE, so they wanted you to get kind of in with that. But of course, the .NET languages were starting to come along too, and they started their whole MSDN and TechNet stuff. And so they wanted you to get your Microsoft, what they call Microsoft certifications at the time, and it was around .NET and C# and Visual Basic at the time too, a very big time. And then the stack at that time, the stack just kept growing and growing and growing, and the certifications kept growing and growing and growing. And now I think those certifications are just as big as, on the networking side, the Cisco certifications, the Microsoft certifications are just as big as those today. So you can get a pretty good pretty good job just getting Microsoft certified.
You know, Padre, I don't know about you, but for a lot of the experts that we talk to, it feels like the more languages that you know, the better chances you have of getting a job at your dream company.
Right, right. And that's actually one of the things that we have been really pushing on Coding 101, which is don't get wedded to a language. It's okay to have your favorite language, but you need to learn all languages. You need to figure out the different ways to complete any given problem. And Lou, actually, that's something I want to throw over to you, because you talk about this transition into visual languages, which mm-hmm. was very different from what came before. I remember the very first time I touched a visual language, I realized, wow, I'm not going to have a lot of those interrupt problems. I'm not going to have a lot of trouble interacting with hardware that's connected to the computer. That's all taken care of in the back end. This is a high enough language where I could really, once I get my basic vocabulary down, work on problem solving rather than fighting the language. What was your first visual language?
So I started on Visual C++, and that was a little bit in college, but mostly when I started at Microsoft. And in fact, I got the job at Microsoft programming in, they made me program in just straight C. So I just was fine with coding in just straight C. So, but when I went there, they obviously want all their software was mostly developed in C++, or actually there was some Fortran actually things. You would be surprised. I wish I could tell you what was, but you would laugh if you knew what was. So anyways, there's a lot of things in C++, and so I had to learn that pretty quickly. And so I learned that, and then, you know, and even C# at the time, it was just growing, so I learned Visual C#. So those two in parallel. And at the time, .NET was kind of slow. It wasn't, you know, nowadays people think that .NET is still slow for some reason, but with, I don't know if you guys have heard of .NET Native, it's some of the new things where they actually compile the C# code down to machine code now instead of intermediary language or IL code. And so now it's becoming almost the same performance as your C++, and so, or as your native languages. And so now, you know, visual languages like that just make it really easy for you to build GUIs and drag and drop things. And like you said, build, you know, to talk to hardware, I can just drag and drop a module into my program, and it will pull in a bunch of libraries that I can then talk to the hardware pretty easily. So yeah, so obviously working at Microsoft, mostly Visual Studio and Visual C and Visual C++.
The other guy in the chat room wants to know about that language, that program that was in Fortran, and he says, it's Clippy, isn't it?
Could be.
we've actually got another really good question from JJ in the chat room, who he asked, well, how many languages should one learn? And you know, my thing is, what you want is you want a spread of languages, right? You definitely
think
want
would be a set amount.
Yeah, it's not a set amount, but like you want a compiled language, you want an interpreted language, so just so you understand the difference between the two. Would you ever suggest someone learn assembly?
You know, it all depends. Like for me, I know guys, like a guy at work, so I'm working at Microsoft for 10 years, you tend to meet these crazy eccentric people, but super smart genius people too, like Raymond Chen. I don't know if you guys have heard of him, but he's like from the original Microsoft Windows NT days, and he swears that at sometimes like he will inline in his C code, in C++ code, he will inline code in assembly just so he could do things faster and more performant than he could do in C++. And so like there are still people that do that, like a lot of some of the Azure stuff, when storage, some of it might be even coded in assembly. A lot of the hardware, I'm sure that stuff in Xbox or you know, hardware based Surface, I'm sure there's some assembly in there. So it all depends on what you want to do, to, you know, what you're interested in. If you want to go into hardware, if you want to understand that low level stuff, assembly is where it's at. But again, learning assembly will help you actually become a better C++ or C coder too, because, you know, obviously it gets coded or compiled down to that, and you can actually debug in assembly or machine code. So it's, you know, those understanding of those low-level things make you a commodity in this type of market from a programming standpoint.
That's interesting, because that's actually a really good hint. That's one of the ways that you can set yourself aside from the rest of the market, and that is to say, look, I know assembly. I know a language that very few people are willing to pick up because it is such a pain in the butt. I remember when I was in college, the only time we would ever do assembly is when we needed something to run more quickly. That, you know, the compiled language was just not running fast enough. But realistically, with the advent of crazy, crazy fast supercomputing in your phone, I haven't had the need to switch anything down into assembly probably in 20 years.
Yeah. Like 8-Bit Steve just said, he said in the chat room, he said, oh, yeah, that learning assembly is learning how computers work. And he's like 100% correct. I mean, that it's really learning how these massive processors with all these instruction sets on them today, like how what they do and how they do it. And, you know, ARM processors do how they do it different than 80x86 processors or AMD 64 processors do, and how they do it differently and how they load things into memory and how they have caches and all this stuff. I mean, once you start to learn that low level, then doing the upper languages, the higher, what they call higher level languages like C, C++, you know, all the, even the interpreted languages, even higher level, you tend to understand what's going on under the covers. So when you write something, you like, oh, well, I'm creating a whole bunch of things in memory, and then I'm creating multi-threaded programs, which let the CPU think at different times on different threads, and I'm forcing the CPU with a one core to what they call context switch, so it has to switch back and forth, and I know the registers are getting overloaded, and blah, 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 and on and on and on, and that's because you learned the lower-level language, really how the CPU or the machine works, and I think that, you know, if you're really serious about understanding that and performance sometimes, it's better to learn those lower level languages.
Yeah, and something else I think the lower languages give you is it really helps you at the beginning. I'm not talking about for experts. I'm talking for people at the 101 level. Is when you pick up something like assembly, you understand what a high level language is and what a low level language is, and you understand what the high level language has to do in order for it to be understood by the machine. Okay. I know for me, when I was in college, that was sort of the light bulb moment when I started doing assembly and I realized what a pain in the butt was. And I was like, oh, that's what my compiler does. Okay, No wonder. No wonder why we're learning this.
Yeah, and it really bothers me because a lot of universities today are teaching just the high level stuff. Like the university I went to get my master's degree at, they for computer science, they taught, they only taught like where they were teaching people Java. And not that Java's bad, but you know,
Java's bad. We can say that.
It's a runtime, and you know, language. It's a runtime language, right? And so, meaning you write some code, it compiles it down to what they call intermediary language, and then that gets what they call JITted at runtime. And there's lots of abstraction, what we call abstraction layers, in between your code and what the machine actually reads. And so, you really have not much understanding of what's going on under the hood. And when it comes to performance and you know, that type of thing, you're not going to get like the, you know, wheels to the rubber to the cement type thing, rubber to the tar, whatever you call it, you know, type speed. You know, you're just not going to get it out of those things. They're getting better now, obviously, with the new runtimes and all that stuff. But, still not there.
They still do offer Java in college. Like, that's one of the main electives that you can choose from, especially if your major doesn't end up being in computer technology.
Right.
I have a question for you, Lou. Sometimes when I get really, really frustrated, I have to come up with a way to just escape from my programming. I have to leave it for a day and then come back the next day, and I can usually solve whatever problem I might have. Now, you've been programming for over 10 years. Have you come up with a routine or some way to keep yourself from getting so frustrated that you just want to quit?
So, yeah, and that goes back to, so you're going to laugh, but I actually will switch. So I'll be doing something in one language and something like really monotonous sometimes in a coding language. And then I'll go and switch to a much, I wouldn't say simpler, but much higher level language. And I'll go do something fun. Like my son and I have been messing with some, you know, embedded type things, and we'll mess around with and create little robotic things and stuff, fun stuff that's easier to do. It takes my mind off of these other monotonous tasks that I've been, or these hard tasks that I've been trying to do. So some people actually will go and do something else, like they'll go fishing or something. But for me, I just change technologies.
So
that helps me.
You fix your aggravation by switching from one program to another program.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right.
I think I've ignited a miniature war in the chat room with a Java comment. And Lou, actually, I think we could bring you in on this because you probably have some decent point of view on this.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever programmers, experienced programmers, start lamenting about Java, it's typically not because of the language. It's because it's so easy to get things running in Java that it's also incredibly easy to get things running poorly in Java. And like 90% of the Java code base out there is just horribly put together code that works, but it's I mean, if you had been programming in any other language, any other high-level language, you would never have assembled it that way. Has that been your experience? I mean, do you hear Java backlash every once in a while?
Yeah, I mean, maybe, yeah, we should definitely clarify, because when I said Java, I was talking about the Java of the time, you know, years ago when, you know, Sun had it, or, you know, all these different, you know, when they kind of, I wouldn't say bastardized it, but they made it really slow. Like you said, you could do really easy, make things really bad very quickly. And, you know, and it, to be honest with you, actually, I code in a little bit of Java, because we actually have we're working on some, you know, Android-based things at Microsoft. And so we definitely, you know, code in Java. But, you know, it's getting a lot better. And a lot of times, just like C#, there's misconceptions about C# and .NET being slow now, when it's actually really, really fast. In fact, sometimes faster than native code.
Yeah.
But Java's the same way. Like, you know, the misconception is you can do things. It depends on the runtime, too. Like, you know, Google's really done a great job at their runtime just really optimized it to where now it's running pretty darn good, especially on ARM processors. And, you know, and they've done a really fantastic job. But if you still use the older versions, or some of the versions have been kind of bastardized by other companies, then they tend to, like you said, you can get into a rock and a hard place pretty easily.
Right. Lou, let's go into some of your programming experience. Let me confess here, one of the reasons why we wanted you on is not just because we missed you and we wanted to see you again, but also because you offer a unique perspective. We've had guests on Coding 101 before, and what you give us that's different is that you are coding each and every single day, and you are switching languages a lot. You tend to be language agnostic. I mean, you have your personal favorites, but I've seen you program in other languages. So break it down for me. When you are presented with some sort of challenge, either handed down to you by a team leader or given to you from on up above, saying, we need something that does this. Mm-hmm. What's your process? I mean, how do you decide what language am I going to use? How am I going to program this? How am I going to break it down? How do I parcel this out to my team? Coming from someone who's actually working in the industry today in some of the most useful programming available to us, how do you program? How do you do it?
Yeah, that's a loaded question. I'll try to simplify the answer. So, like, normally what happens, especially in the division that I work in, is we work on tools that are not only platforms, so like other developers externally have to build on top of it, but we also work for just normal consumers too. So we need to be able to them to use it just by using, you know, a GUI or a UI to actually click and drag and stuff, right? So we have to be able to do both. And so when I'm brought a problem, most of the time it's, you know, how can we get this to the most broadest audience? Like, if I wanted to do both a developer type thing as well as a consumer type thing, like, for instance, a lot of things that we're doing internally is we'll do a lot of things in TypeScript, which I don't know if you've heard of before, but TypeScript is just a version of JavaScript, another language that compiles down to JavaScript, but allows us to compile it and run it through special checkers and stuff. But we'll code a lot of things in that, and then we'll wrap it with like a C++ or native shell that just does very simple things. And then we allow developers to then code all their logic and business logic and stuff in JavaScript. And then we make it so that it's very easy. But then there's other places where you need just raw speed. Like, we need to, large amounts of data import into a big database is not, you know, JavaScript's just not going to do it for us. So we're going to need to do something else where, you know, maybe we use, you know, .NET native or native code to, you know, get the data from a stream from the internet, you know, from a REST service or web service or WCF or something, and then we go and run some logic on it, validation logic, and we just shove it into a table. And so that would require a different language. So it's really all dependent on what the requirement is. Like, when they come to us, they'll give us a requirement saying we need it to do this. We need it to import data from Salesforce.com and shove it into Dynamics CRM, Microsoft CRM kind of thing. And we need to do that to be fast, and we need it to do performant. And they have a bunch of listed requirements that they give you, and then you take those requirements and you manifest them into what the technologies are required for. So that's really how I do it, from a high level at least.
I like it. Is it safe to say that really any complex software system today is not going to be written in a single language? That just doesn't happen anymore, right? I mean, every problem is going to have a language that handles it better. And if you're a good developer, you're going to be able to know where you should slide.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, our software is, I mean, just the software that I own right now, I own our rich client, and it's, or what we call a desktop client, and it's coded in native C++, C#, JavaScript. It's also got TypeScript. It's got, I mean, you name it. It's programming. It's got a whole bunch of languages, and they're just pieced together by the operating system pieces them together using these libraries. And so you can have different runtimes running at different times and doing different things. And like I said, each piece of it has a different purpose. So like some of it's for only developers, and some of it's for making sure the UI is really fast and responsive. So there's just like XML, scripting, all that type of stuff. There's just a ton of stuff under the hood. And most languages are like that. I mean, if you were to ever see the code for Word, I mean, it's many different languages too. And, just a Word application. Even an application on the internet today, if you wanted to build a cloud service, up in Azure, at Amazon Web Services, you'll be coding in, whether it's Python or it's JavaScript, with Node.js, or there's just many different things. You just got to look at what the problem space is, and then once you know about different languages, you can kind of piece together the right technologies together.
We do have to wrap it up, but we do have some great questions from the chat room. One of the things that's really popping up right now is Go. It's kind of a hot language at the moment. Google Go is a language that they've created, and it's supposed to be very easy to access for people who are starting out. Have you had any experience with Go yet, or have you played with it?
I haven't. I'll be honest, I haven't looked at it yet. I've read a little bit about it, and I've seen a little bit about it, how they've brought in some students to try it out, but I haven't actually read about what it is. If it's a compiled language, if it's a interpreted language, I really don't know too much specifics on it.
Yeah. Lou Maresca, we want to thank you again for spending your time with the Coding 101 audience. It's always great to have you back. And we promise at some point we will swing back around to you because, Shannon.
We will.
Yeah, we're not going to let Lou go.
Everybody loves you.
Sorry, that's how it's going to
work.
But before you go, I'd like to give you a chance to tell people, first of all, where they could find you, but also if you could pass on some of your guru wisdom, because you didn't really get a chance to do this when you were our code warrior. What would you want to tell the young programmer out there, the young man, the young woman who is getting into the game, who is perhaps seeing what different languages can do? What would you tell them if they actually wanted a career in this that they should do to make sure that they've got the boxes checked off?
So what I've learned over the last 10 years is the best thing to do to learn something is to reach out to somebody that either knows it already or is willing to offer up a little bit of information on how and what they do. And there's always somebody willing. Like I work with people, at a big company, whether you work at Apple or Google or Microsoft or any big company, they have people that are very, very good at what they do. Some people are not willing to share and some people are willing to share. And you find more people are willing to share about their experiences than the people that are not. And so if you want to learn how to game program, reach out to somebody on, there's plenty of forums and sites out there, people just willing to share. They want the credit of sharing information, and just go out there and ask questions like, what technologies do I need to learn, or to build a game, or what technologies do I need to build a telemetry system for weather. I don't know. I don't care whatever you want to do, right? Just you think about what you want to do and you just go and find somebody who's either trying to do it or have done it before. Just look at some of the Kickstarter projects out there. I've emailed people in Kickstarter before and just been like, how did you do that? Like, I'm just curious. You don't have to give up any secrets, but and they'll be like, oh, here's the technology. Just go check out this library or go check out this, this processor that we've got from China or whatever. They'll give me very specific details, not like how they did it, but they'll give me technologies and I'll go and research and be like, this stuff's pretty cool. So, you just have to reach out to people. I think that's the key is nowadays there's a lot of books on some things, but they're not as specific. And so you can go find on Amazon a bunch of books on how to do things, but they're not specific enough. And so that's why you need to reach out to somebody to get that information. So I think that's the biggest key in today's world, especially with the internet, it's much easier.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Lou Maresca, he will always, always be our code warrior. Lou, where can the people find you if they want to find more about what you're doing or what projects you're working on?
Sure. You always find me on Twitter at LouMM. And all the work that I'm doing is at crm.dynamics.com. And, again, look out for some more projects for me, and of course, on Google+ as well. Louis Maresca on there, and look out for some personal stuff. I'm working on some personal stuff that's coming out soon too. So check out Twitter feed for that.
Lou, we love you. Thank you for coming back.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys, for having me.
Now, Snubs, I know this was a lot of information to throw in. We don't typically do show notes like we do for our regular programming lessons because we're not programming Lou. But but if they wanted to find notes about all the programming that we've done, where do they find it?
You can go to twit.tv/C101, and our GitHub is also on there where you can download all of the code that we go over every week.
That's right. And it's also, it's a really good place to get back episodes and perhaps to find
absolutely.
That lesson that you've missed. And yeah, if you go to the GitHub, we separate them out by our individual programming modules. So you can always find all the code that we use on the show. That's very important because it means you can imitate anything that we do so you could learn on your own. That's, again, as Lou said, that's one of the things that you really want to do. You want to get in there. You want to tinker. You want to ask
questions.
Break things. Break things and fix them. Also, you could find us on iTunes. Please subscribe. We're still a hot podcast in iTunes, which I love.
Yay!
But you can also find us, and hopefully you will join us in our G+ community, which
yes.
I believe is, oh, there it is, right there. Just look for Coding 101. It's gplus.to/TwitCoding101. Right. Now, we've got over 1,000 members of this community right now. One of the cool things about that community is we've got people who are starting, we've got people who are intermediate, advanced, and we've got people who are experts. So if you've got a question about coding, if you've got a question about a language, if you have a question about a lesson, that's the place to go because, again, if you're part of a community, you'll learn that much faster.
Guess where else we are?
Where?
We're on Twitter.
No way.
Yeah, if you're not a big Google person, that's okay because we are both on Twitter as well. I'm twitter.com/snubs.
Yeah, and I'm at PadreSJ. That's at PadreSJ. Yeah.
And we also do the show live over at live.twit.tv. Mm-hmm. And you can join our chat room, which you saw during this show. We do take some questions from you guys, from the viewers. And that is irc.twit.tv.
Yeah, and it's all part of the experience of what it means to be part of the Twit TV network. This isn't TV, folks. This is an interactive forum where we reach out, we find out what you want, what you need, and we try to give it to you.
This is fun stuff.
It is fun stuff.
Woo.
Until next time. I'm Father Robert Balliser.
I'm Shannon Morse.
End of line.